The Words We Live By. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present Wisdom Books of the Bible, the first in this series of 15 outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel, two of America's foremost men of letters. Mr. Samuel.
Mark, I'm glad to be here again with you, and I'm glad now that we have this subject before us, the Wisdom Books of the Bible. I say I'm glad now because when we first agreed to discuss these books, I was a little perturbed. They're rather difficult books, and there's much in them that puzzles and teases me, and I have many questions to put to you, but I think that we can get some interesting ideas by discussing the text between us. But before we do that, I do want to make clear to the listeners that the Wisdom Books of the Bible is a phrase that doesn't occur in the Bible itself. It's a recent phrase. It denotes three books particularly or exclusively: the book of Proverbs, the book Ecclesiastes, and the book of Job. And these three, under that name, are in a sense set apart by modern critics or modern commentators as representing a specific outlook, the wisdom outlook. And in fact, the first question I would like to put to you is, do you feel there is about these books a specific character such as justifies their being put into a category of their own, the wisdom books?
Oh, I think so indeed. But first, Maurice, I would like to remind you that our hope is to be able to reach out a little farther and mention two or three works that are on the periphery of this subject. That is to say, two books that are not in the canon, the book of Ecclesiasticus and the book called The Wisdom of Solomon, as well as a book that I believe was never anywhere near the canon, a book usually known as The Ethics of the Fathers.
I'm glad you mentioned that. The interesting thing is that Proverbs and Ecclesiastes were themselves under discussion as to their suitability for a canon. In Proverbs, there happens to be, as you know, a good deal of material which seems to be of a purely secular character, and then in one place at least there is such a flat, apparent contradiction as to how to answer a fool that the people dealing with the canon were deeply distressed and thought of leaving the book out. Also, the book Ecclesiastes might have been left out of the canon. And actually, I think that Ecclesiasticus should have been put in the canon.
We don't need to worry about the fact that we have two or three works that are not normally found in the Bible, books that we shall want to bring into our discussion somehow or other. In other words, there's a total of six rather than a total of three, isn't there?
Yes, if you include the Ethics of the Fathers, that makes six. There are even other books, but that would lead us too far astray. What I would like to note at this particular moment is, when I mentioned to some friends that we would be talking on these subjects, and I mentioned Ecclesiasticus as well as Ecclesiastes, I discovered to my dismay that a great many of them didn't know the difference, didn't know there was an Ecclesiastes in the Bible and an Ecclesiasticus outside the Bible in what is called the Apocrypha. So that if any of our listeners are a bit confused, let's have that clarified now.
Yes, yes, I thought it might not hurt now, although we shall go ahead and talk about the whole wisdom literature as if it were one literature. I think, to answer your original question, and I'm sorry I delayed my answer, I think that it is one literature. There is a theme that is constant throughout all of these books. It is the theme of wisdom. Wisdom has a rather special meaning in these books. To ask me what wisdom is to ask me a very difficult question. It's rather curious. I think everybody knows what wisdom is. Everybody knows what a wise man is, just as everyone knows what an unwise man is. Everyone knows what a wise action is. Everyone knows what an unwise action is. We're all perfectly familiar with the distinction, and yet, if we are forced to say what we mean by the word, it is difficult to do so. I was interested in a derivation of the word wise, the English word wise, which traces it back through the Indo-European languages to the word to see. The Latin word videre is connected, apparently.
Yes.
It means some kind of 20/20 vision, some kind of perfect eyesight, a clear and complete, or at any rate, unmistaken comprehension of what the world is like. And that relates the term for me with a meaning that it's had for a long time among all peoples, among the Greeks, for instance, who always talked about wisdom as a primary virtue. It seems to have meant sometimes not much more than knowing what the world is like, knowing the truth about things, knowing things in their proportions, in their true outlines. Wisdom is a worldly virtue.
Well, how far would you stretch the concept of wisdom? I agree that it's difficult to define. It's something to be felt rather than described. And if it's described at all, it must be by reference and by allusion and tangentially. But isn't it something more than a knowledge of how to do things, know-how in human relations? As far as I can make out, in the Bible, it very frequently, this concept of wisdom, stretches out into something like a philosophy of the universe as well. And it includes not only our feelings with regard to the significance of existence as such, but deals with the material of the universe. It has to do with astronomy, with biology, with the animal kingdom. It's not just worldly know-how.
Oh, know-how, by no means, is an equivalent, or is a proper translation of the term. We have a word, cunning, which could be defined as knowing. Yeah, the cunning man is the knowing man. And when we say that, we mean, really, that he doesn't know very much. He knows only his own advantage. He knows tricks. He knows how to secure his own advantage and get a long way past someone else. But I think no one thinks of that as the same thing as wisdom. And just so, we often say that someone is knowing or knowledgeable, and we do not give him credit for any profundity of understanding. I quite agree with you that when I said wisdom is somehow the ability to see the world as it is, as it necessarily is and eternally is, I should have said, perhaps instead of world, the universe. Yes, in its farthest reaches, I believe the truth about existence is a thing that the wise man somehow sees, somehow understands.
You know, when I began by asking you whether there was complete justification, Mark, for the separation of the wisdom books, I had in mind the fact that the word wisdom, the Hebrew word chokhmah, occurs in the Bible for the first time in connection, oddly enough, with a technique. You remember when Moses had to build the tabernacle in the wilderness, he was bidden by God to put a certain man to the task, Bezalel. And we find that Bezalel, the son of Uri, says God, I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and in understanding and in knowledge and in all manner of workmanship to devise skillful works, to work in gold and in silver and in brass. That's where the word wisdom occurs for the first time. And the second time, again, it occurs in a similar connection when Solomon hired the Phoenician Hiram, not the king of Tyre, but a certain Hiram, to help him build a temple. Again, this Hiram was filled with wisdom and knowledge and understanding. And oddly enough, those three words keep recurring like a triad. It's always wisdom, which is a Hebrew word, is chokhmah, and understanding, which is tevuna, and knowledge, which is da'at. Those three words come together, and as I said, their first occurrence is in connection with an art, and not with a specific attitude toward life of the wise man.
Yes, of course, The Greeks were wonderful, it seems to me, on that, too. For them, the art of anything was the knowing how to do it. The art of writing, the art of poetry was the knowledge of how to write a poem. The art of building was the knowledge of how to build a house or a boat or something of the sort. On the other hand, we don't ourselves these days say a wise carpenter, do we? We say a good carpenter. We say a carpenter who knows how to build a house. We wouldn't call him wise because he was successful at the job.
Well,
wisdom might be in the man who's going to live in the house or who designed the house. He might unwisely tell the carpenter to build a certain kind of house, but we think of a carpenter as no more than a man who knows how to go ahead and build a house that he's been asked to build. There might be some wisdom, Maurice, or unwisdom in the mind of the man who designed the house. I've always been interested in the question and I alluded to this a minute ago, whether wisdom is in any sense a transcendental virtue, whether its final reference is ever very definitely to things outside of the world men live in. I've usually supposed that wisdom, at its very best, meant knowing how to live in the world, knowing how to live among men. Now, to be sure, the wisest man of all, if we know who he was, probably would have his final reference, his final gaze, set upon something outside the world. He might have a very long view of things, and it meant that his motions down here, back and forth, would seem to be guided by a ray, guided by a beam that was set very far away from him. Whereas the person who had no such vision as that, who couldn't see very far, would be running around like a rabbit or a mouse without any sense in his motions. He would do this and then do that, would never seem to know why he did any of these things, and his doings also would be incomprehensible to others. He would be a silly, ineffectual person.
Well, do you think, Mark, that what you're saying now is the attitude in the wisdom books of the Bible, or is this your interpretation and you want to reconcile the two?
Well,
my feeling is that in the biblical or the Jewish biblical approach to wisdom, the view that you've just outlined is only one part of it. In the biblical book, first of all, they begin, of course, with the religious aspect. It's got to be, over and over again, we get the observation, as in the beginning of Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, or the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And then it branches out in several directions. The direction which you have just indicated, namely the serene, I won't call it remote, but partially detached, at any rate, unegocentric attitude is implied. But also there is implied, I'll put it rather vulgarly, that a man's got to know on which side his bread is buttered. You asked before the distinction between wisdom and cunning. Certainly cunning hasn't got the range of wisdom. And I would define the difference between the two as follows, that wisdom is the strategy of love in human relationships, and cunning is the strategy of hatred in human relationships.
That's very good.
But only in human relationships. You can't talk of cunning as applied to one's attitude toward God, toward history, toward social problems. So the question emerges, in this attitude that you outlined before, is that a God-oriented attitude? Is it the Greek attitude? And if so, is it completely at one with the Jewish attitude, which begins with, God is the first essential in computing a man's wisdom? If God is present, it's wisdom. If not, it's not wisdom.
Well, I think that's ultimately right. For instance, it does sound absurd to think of someone who was cunning toward God. The wisdom literature makes it very clear that you cannot deceive God. He sees all that you do. He hears all that you do. He even writes down in a book all that you do, or someone does up there. Remember one of the Proverbs runs, I think, to that effect, or maybe it's in one of the other books that I came across this. Remember in everything that you do that there is a seeing eye, a hearing ear, and a book in which every one of your deeds is written down.
Yes, they go further. They say that you can, the shopkeeper is there, you can buy as much as you want, but someday you'll have to pay the price. That's in the Ethics of the Fathers.
Oh, that's where it is.
Now, yes.
I'm trying to, perhaps, to reconcile two things. I'm not at all sure that it is that there's any necessity of reconciliation. I take it that wisdom finally means not only knowledge of how to live hour by hour, day by day, to save your own life, to keep on living, not to throw your life away with foolish and absurd things. You must somehow conserve yourself. But if your actions really make any sense, they make sense in eternity, so to speak. They make sense at some point very far removed from this particular point on which we stand. Otherwise, there is no true measure, it seems to me, of a man's actions. I believe the authors of these books understood that very well, because sometimes they say it's the part of wisdom to be silent, the part of wisdom not to do very much. You know, they advise against incessant activity.
Yes, they alternate in examining the question of wisdom. They take up different viewpoints, depart from different, use different measures, and you've got to get the totality in order to understand what they mean by it. For instance, in the very first chapter of the book of Proverbs, we read, "Wisdom crieth aloud in the street. She uttereth her voice in the broad places. She calleth at the head of the noisy streets. At the entrance of the gates in the city, she uttereth her words. How long, ye thoughtless, will ye be thoughtless? Will ye love thoughtlessness? How long will scorners delight in scorning?" Now, this obviously refers to human relationships. But then in chapter 8, there begins a lyrical dithyramb to wisdom, which is totally divorced from human experience. When he says, "The Lord made me," this is wisdom speaking.
Yes.
"The Lord made me as the beginning of his way, the first of his works of old. I was set up from everlasting, from the beginning. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he set a circle upon the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he gave to the sea his decree." That is also the function of wisdom. On the one hand, wisdom to teach a man how to behave. On the other hand, wisdom which inspires a man to consider the ultimate mysteries of creation. And it seems that somehow one must establish a bridge. I find it difficult. Establish a bridge between the two. One can't consider them both simultaneously, or can you?
It's very difficult. I might remind you that, to name a famous Greek, Aristotle, in his Ethics, writes 9 books about how to live in this world, how to behave, how to try to find the mean between the extremes of behavior, both of which are bad and foolish. But he writes a 10th book in which he says, after all, the wise man finally sits down and contemplates those things over which he has no control. He merely contemplates them. He merely remembers that although he is in charge of his life a great deal of the time, yet there are times where he is not in charge of his life. He cannot control the weather. He cannot control life and death. He cannot decide not to die. He cannot understand, perhaps, the ultimate things in the universe. And Aristotle is suggesting that unless a man is able to contemplate the uncontrollable, the infinite, in that way, then he will not even be a good lawyer. He will not even be a good doctor tomorrow morning. There will be something foolish about
that. Now, Mark, do you make a distinction between the outlook of the Greeks on wisdom and the outlook of the Hebrews as it's contained in these wisdom books and in their peripheral books?
Well, curiously speaking, Maurice, I do not. For instance, I find all sorts of things here that the Greeks said. One of the sentences in one of these books is this: "Consider no man happy until he is dead." That is precisely what what Solon said.
Yes,
in Herodotus. In other words, maybe you don't know how your life is running. Maybe you don't know whether you have a right to call yourself happy until your last deed has been done. It may be the worst of all, or some calamity may occur to you. No, I think that the Greeks often meant by wisdom something very much like what is meant here. I suspect we do too. I suspect that the human race holds on very tight to the notion that the wise man is not only a shrewd and a cunning man when he needs to be that, and knows how to live and keep on living, and knows how not to get killed, and knows how not to become a pauper and not to be a charge on his friends and the relations in the state, but also ultimately sees things that keep him, that make him silent, see things that make him, well, just to come back to a tautology, wise. Now, there's another question that hangs on this. What is the relation between religion and ethics? In connection with almost every religion that's found in the world, an ethic is found. I sometimes wonder if it isn't difficult to bridge that gap, too. Sometimes the ethics...
Now, Mark, you're raising so many questions, I'm becoming dizzy.
Well, sometimes the ethics don't seem to follow in any logical way from the mystery.
No, that's perfectly true, but my mind is still working on something that you said before. That
all right, then, go on back.
I'm blocked at it.
Fine.
When you say that the Greeks and the Hebrews had pretty much the same outlook, and you correctly quoted something, there are many quotations which would support your thesis, certainly the Stoic outlook on a man's behavior is reflected very frequently in the Proverbs and in the ethics of the fathers. Nevertheless, I can't help thinking that there's a tremendous difference between the Greek and the Hebrew outlook on wisdom, which could very well be epitomized in, on the one hand, among the Greeks, there was a systematic attempt to answer the riddle of the creation of the universe in what we call the scientific spirit. That is to say, they didn't have our modern scientific equipment, but they had the modern scientific outlook, and indeed they did launch the atomic theory, they launched a great many of the logical methods of modern science. The Hebrews didn't do that. Over and over again among the Hebrews you get passages like this. This is from the book of Proverbs, and the words are attributed to Agur, the son of Yakeh. And he says, "Surely I am brutish, unlike a man, and have not the understanding of a man, and I have not learned wisdom that I should have the knowledge of the Holy One." And then he implies that it's not for a man to know. He says, "Who hath ascended up into heaven and descended? Who hath gathered the wind in his fists? Who hath bound the waters in his garment?" This is the theme, as you know, which is going to recur in our discussion of Job. Now, the curious thing is that on this question of measuring the universe, the Greeks were active at about the time these wisdom books were being collected or edited, some say were being written. And as you remember, at that time, Eratosthenes had already measured the circumference of the earth within something like 5% accurately. So that when the Hebrews talked of wisdom, they talked of awe before the riddles of the universe. When the Greeks talked of wisdom, while there was a congruence in certain areas, the Greeks said that the universe is something to be investigated, and the element of awe, a belief in an ultimate unknowability, is absent from their outlook.
Well,
do you feel that's the case?
No, not quite. I think in substance, you're right. The Greeks were more interested in measuring the world that they found before them than in wondering where it came from. Their speculations were usually not very acute with respect to the question of creation. I think they assumed the world had always been here. Here it was, and they more or less serenely started out to measure it or to reproduce it in the forms of art. They were great scientists and artists. And we think of the Jews as being much fuller, well, completely full of the idea that God made the world. That before it was made, it had not been. The Greeks famously could not understand how anything could come out of nothing. But the Hebrews could understand it very easily. They knew that the world had come out of nothing. God had made it out of nothing. I only want to say that in the greatest Greek minds, you find at least a residue of doubt that the human mind can go all the way through the world. I mean, I'm speaking of the 10th book of the Ethics, for instance.
Yes.
And some of Plato's ideas are in a world that the mind really cannot reach.
No, that we only see the shadow of that famous story of his in the cave.
That's right.
The lights in the cave. But I'm speaking of the physical universe. The Greeks were determined to discover it, and the Hebrews had apparently given up hope. Not that they despised knowledge in that direction, but they believed that ultimately we should find ourselves blocked by human incapacity.
Oh, I think you're quite right. You don't think of the Jews as scientists and mathematicians. They're first of all religious and ethical men. There is a very interesting sentence in Ecclesiasticus that has teased many philosophers. God is referred to as Him who made all things in number, weight, and measure. That is to say, He made them so that men could number them, weigh them, and measure them. If he hadn't done that, of course, then science would not be possible. But that sentence is interesting for its uniqueness as much as anything else. Nothing else, so far as I know, like that is ever said in the wisdom literature.
Now, there is some reference in Job, when we'll come to that, how God did things with exactitude, It occurs also in Proverbs. But now let me come to the question that you raised before about the relationship between a religion and its ethics. How would you relate the distinction that we both of us accept in different degrees, this distinction between the Greeks and the Hebrews? How would you relate that to the difference in ethical outlook between the two? Namely, the Jewish God-centered concept of the universe and the Greek... The Greeks made man much more the center of the universe, didn't they?
Yes.
In fact, you can put it this way. Among the Greeks, the greatest saying was, man, know thyself.
Yes.
And among the Hebrews, the saying was, the fear of God is the beginning of knowledge. Now, how would that be reflected in the diversity of their ethical outlooks?
I think it would be reflected in this way, that the Jews never let us forget that the ultimate reference is to God. They are saying that all the time. Even though, in their minds, I think they were implying it, even when they talked about very commonplace, ordinary, everyday emergencies in life, how you do this and how you do that, I think they understood that even those practical decisions were made under the eye of God and in the hearing of God. God is always in their minds, and nothing like that is in the Greek mind. I quite agree. Although they may often, when they are talking about everyday affairs, they often say the same thing.
Oh, they're bound to.
As men always will, yes. Everywhere in the world, as we do now.
Yes, they're bound to do that. But I suppose we would get a clearer view if, and I hope we'll be able to do this on our next session, by actually going into the Proverbs, analyzing some of them along the coordinates that we've just spoken about, and see whether they do reflect a particularity that we don't find somewhere else. What I would like you to think about in between is this question, whether there is an ultimate difference expressing itself in the social outlook. You just said there is a difference between the ethics as a result of the diversity of reference points. Would that produce a difference in outlook on the social structure, on the right social structure?
I think it might very well do so.
Then we'll go into that in our next talk, and by chapter and verse, see if we can elucidate it.
All right, sir.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the first in the 15-week Eternal Light Summer Series. We invite you to join us again next week for another in this series of outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel. Our program will be the second of five, entitled Wisdom Books of the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.